This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating from WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we have rapid developments in post-Jamahiriya Libya today. There are conflicting statements from Libyan rebels who are denying the UN Secretary General's plan for multinational occupation, yet at the same time imploring for more intervention from NATO, the nation of Qatar, and the Arab Emirates. We'll have the latest from the United Nations and other sources on those developments. Also today, racist rebels' reactionary actions against Afro-Libyans and black workers inside the country. Amnesty International is on the scene, and after witnessing black Libyans being targeted and taken from hospitals and apartments, Amnesty says that black Libyans and sub-Saharan Africans are at high risk of abuse by anti-Gaddafi forces. We'll speak live with Amnesty in Tripoli later in today's program. This is 5 o'clock shadow. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Later in the program, we'll have details on racist repression and reaction by rebels against Afro-Libyans. But we begin with the latest developments in regard to who will occupy and militarily control Libya in the near future. In our Monday program, we spoke with Matthew Lee of the Intercity Press that obtained internal Security Council memorandum that envisioned the emplacement of a multinational force for an indefinite time in Libya, along with military police from the United Nations and so-called unarmed military observers from the UN. Overnight, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, addressed the Security Council, and he said in part, "Time is of the essence. The people of Libya are looking to the international community for help. The transitional government will be outlining specific requests in the coming days. My aim," said Ban Ki-moon, "is to get UN personnel on the ground absolutely as quickly as possible under a robust Security Council mandate. My special advisor, Mr. Ian Martin, has been consulting daily with the National Transitional Council and other Libyan stakeholders, as have I and other senior members of our team." He says that rapid response and delivery is important. Mr. Martin and his team have been engaged in a preparatory process to enable the UN to respond swiftly to requests by the Libyan authorities. It appears that they will make requests based on national security, political dialogue, state authority, human rights, and economic recovery, etc. That from the Secretary General briefing the UN Security Council overnight. The release and publication of the Ian Martin memo that basically has what some say is a bias in its reports and recommendations and projections to those of Western powers, and that was not initially circulated among all of the United Nations members until it was made public through the expose of Inner City Press and our interlocutor from earlier this week, Matthew Lee. With the release of that information around the world, there was a reaction from the Transitional National Council, or as it's renaming itself, the National Transitional Council. And according to various sources, there is a bit of a mix-up inside the TNC as to that. There were statements from the TNC overnight that they do not want there to be a multinational force or NATO troops occupying Libya. But at the same time, officials of the TNC are asking for the continued bombing by NATO, continued military and tactical coordination by Qatar and Jordan, and presumably the ongoing intervention, assistance, and logistical aid of clandestine military organizations like the British SAS, United States Special Forces, and French Special Forces. The issue was covered this way by Euronews.
Mustafa Abdel Jalil, head of the Libyan National Transitional Council, has been visiting Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. They're the only two Arab states taking part in the NATO-led international intervention and were among the first nations to recognise the NTC. He has called for no let-up in NATO airstrikes. Muammar Gaddafi has defied the world by challenging coalition forces. He remains a threat not only to the Libyans, but to the world. Therefore, the Libyan people and humanity appeal to allied troops to continue protecting the Libyan people from this tyrant. The NTC's ambassador to the Emirates said Libya was also requesting an immediate unfreezing of $5 billion in assets. More aid is also needed. But what about after the search for Gaddafi and maybe the rebels' full control of Libya? Lots of questions and controversy surrounds the security situation and Libya's relationship with the Arab and international world.
Euronews. That summary courtesy of Euronews. This is 5 o'clock shadow. And our colleague over at the United Nations Bureau of the Inner City Press, Matthew Lee, reports as of today that while the 200 UN military observers envisioned in Ian Martin's leaked August 22nd report to the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon were ruled out by the Russian and the British ambassadors and Martin himself as not being specifically requested by the Libyans. Martin said overnight that NATO's continuing role is what he, as a term of art, referred to as, quote, a factual statement, end quote. Inner City Press goes on to report today that there were objections to the scenario envisioned in the Martin document from China and elsewhere. This is the statement overnight of the Chinese ambassador to the United Nations in regard to the future of Libya.
In Chinese perspective, we think there are four principles which are very important to be followed. First, bring early end to the conflict, because it's extremely important. Without peace, stability, the people will continue to suffer. So that's why it's important to end the conflict. Second, to launch inclusive political process, national reconciliation, and a dialogue as soon as possible. Third, fully respect the sovereignty, territorial integrity of Libya, respect the choices and the will of the Libyan people. The fourth, we must give full play to the leading role, leadership of the UN and the Security Council. Of course, other regional groups, other international mechanisms and conferences, they also have a role to play. Now, these roles are complementary roles, and they must follow the UN Charter and the principles set by the Security Council. So I think that during the consultation by the Security Council, there is a broad consensus. You know, these principles are fully respected and supported by the members of the Council. And we believe that so long as, you know, these principles are respected, international efforts can make progress on Libya. And also, you know, we really appreciate and support the efforts made by African Union in promoting the political settlement of crisis in Libya. Thank you very much.
There's this plan, the Ian Martin plan that's emerged, and it doesn't really talk about a role for the AU, and it says that the NATO will continue to have a role even after the fall of the Gaddafi government. I wonder, what does China think the role of NATO should be after Gaddafi? I mean, they've said that it would continue even after he was either captured or killed. Is that your understanding? And should the UN, in its planning, have the African Union more involved?
Yeah, I think it's a very important question. As I said, we think that there are four principles. One of the principles is that we must end the conflict. So this principle applies to UN operation. So I think there must be a peace. Without peace, people will continue to suffer. So that's why I think it's extremely important to end the armed conflict in Libya. Thank you very much.
Do you think you can unfreeze?
I'm fairly clear in saying that the mandate from 1973 was carried a little bit too far. Do you have concerns about the role individual countries might play or how that might be interpreted in the post-Qaddafi period?
So I think everybody should follow seriously and strictly the UN resolutions. And we are concerned about overstepping that the mandate given by the UN resolutions 1973.
And that was the Chinese ambassador to the United Nations on the issue of what the future and perhaps occupation of Libya might be. And listeners to this program might well have recognized what we believe to be the voice of our guest from earlier this week, Matthew Lee of Inner City Press, asking about what he referred to as the Ian Martin document, that being a 10-page document that envisions a multinational force under the leadership of one particular state, several hundred military police, and an unknown number of unarmed United Nations military observers. The author of that report, Ian Martin, the assistant or advisor to United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon himself, finally faced the press on this very issue, this very question overnight as well. And Inner City was there too. And we now hear the statement on these matters from the author of the controversial 10-page report, Ian Martin.
Very pleased to say that there was a very strong endorsement in the Council of the approach that was reflected in the Secretary-General's statement that we're taking to planning the support of the United Nations to Libya as the conflict comes to an end. A very strong welcome for the fact that the United Nations system had engaged in preparatory work that puts us in a strong position now to be ready to respond to Libyan requests. One of the keynotes, of course, of our own process and now of the Secretary General and all members of the Council is the importance of Libyan ownership, which is why, although we've done a great deal to inform ourselves about the likely post-conflict context, we have only done contingency planning until we were able to engage with Libyan transitional authorities. And as perhaps you know, we've intensified that process through discussions that Special Envoy Al-Khatib and I had in Doha last week and further discussions that I then continued. One thing that is very clear is there's a strong wish in the Council, but also on the part of the NTC, that the UN should play the key role in supporting overall international assistance to Libya in the phase ahead. We are, of course, trying to get United Nations humanitarian personnel into Tripoli and elsewhere in order to assist with some of the urgent issues, particularly the crisis in the water supply, which the Secretary General referred to in his statement, and the a DSS team reached Tripoli today with more of what is necessary to prepare for the safe arrival of further United Nations personnel. And I myself, with a small number of colleagues, are ready to proceed to Tripoli if discussions in Paris with the NTC indicate that the timing is now right for that. Be happy to take your questions.
Is it possible to ask about the report that you prepared? And maybe that's what you're referring to by contingency plans. But there's one of these lines about that NATO will continue to have a role even after the fall of the Qaddafi government. Is that a UN position? What was the basis of that? And is it true that the military observers are no longer really under consideration, that the NTC has said it doesn't want it, as two ambassadors told us out front?
Let me distinguish two things. There is a report that was the culmination of the pre-assessment process for which I was responsible, which brought together all United Nations departments, agencies, funds and programs in an analysis of the Libyan context. That report, which is indeed a report, did not go all the way to propose proposing how the UN would respond for the very reason I said, because of our sensitivity to Libyan ownership and our desire to keep that open, obviously because of uncertainty as to how the situation would finally develop, but also to engagement with Libyan wishes. Following that, last weekend, I reported to the Secretary General on the state of our contingency planning in different areas. One of those areas had been, and I'd previously briefed the Security Council on this, contingency planning for the deployment of unarmed military observers by the United Nations in the context of a ceasefire, which was, of course, what the Security Council sought in its resolutions and was a feature of the various roadmaps that were seeking to bring about a negotiated end to the conflict. So clearly in that context it was responsible to plan for the rapid deployment of unarmed military observers if necessary. And we also told the Council that depending on the security situation, deployment of unarmed military observers might only be possible if there was some kind of protection that would have to be provided other than by the United Nations. So that contingency plan has been there, but it was developed in a context which is not the context that has actually occurred, and in our discussions with the NTC, it's very clear that the Libyans want to avoid any military deployment by the UN or others. They are very seriously interested in assistance with policing to get the public security situation under control and gradually develop a democratically accountable public security force. The reference to NATO that you referred to wasn't an opinion of me or anyone else. It was simply a factual statement.
UN Post Libya Planner for the Secretary General and Security Council at the United Nations, Ian Martin, addressing the press overnight and referring to the projection within his document that is being publicly distanced by the rebels, referring to it as, quote, just a factual statement. For our listeners, we now present a rendering of two of the most important paragraphs of that factual statement, as Mr. Martin would have it, which envisions, at the time of its writing on the 22nd of August, a multinational force under the leadership of one nation, as well as the ongoing participation of NATO in Libyan military affairs. Here are the two key paragraphs from Ian Martin's document.
United Nations post-conflict deployment to Libya. Paragraph 7. The Security Council was informed that, if an interim protection force is required to enable this deployment of unarmed UN military observers, given the time needed for the United Nations to generate and deploy troops, such a presence would have to come, if requested by the Libyans, and authorized by the Council, from some other source, such as a multinational force under a lead nation command. Two member states have been provided with the force requirements for the protection element, and their reactions are awaited. However, the first assumption would be that the unarmed UN military observers, as well as the UN police, would be able to rely on the same protection as their civilian colleagues. Paragraph 8. If the stabilization of Tripoli after the collapse of the Gaddafi government becomes such a major challenge that the transitional authorities leak more robust international assistance, this is a task clearly beyond the capacity of the UN. In this situation, the only viable option to ensure a safe environment in Tripoli are the transitional authorities themselves, with the advice of those who are already assisting or advising them. The Security Council's so-called protection of civilians mandate implemented by NATO does not end with the fall of the Gaddafi government, and, therefore, NATO would continue to have some responsibilities. Ian Martin. The 22nd of August 2011.
We now return to another part of the press conference held overnight at the United Nations with author Ian Martin.
How do you prevent that from morphing into the kind of occupation force that was prohibited by Resolution 1973?
I'm sorry, I thought I'd say clearly we don't now expect military observers to be requested by Libya, so we're not envisaging the deployment of military observers. That was a contingency plan that most likely would have been called upon in the event of a ceasefire. Our discussions today indicate that they're not at all likely to ask for that.
The the UN mission you're planning to Libya, how would you characterize it? Is it a peacekeeping operations, or is it not because it's not involving any armed elements?
Indeed, it's not at the moment being envisioned as a peacekeeping operation, on the assumption that there would not be a kind of operational deployment. It would be an integrated, politically led mission.
The Chinese ambassador, Li Baodong, had said that there should be a role for the African Union. I noticed in your contingency plan, it's not, or at least whatever this document is, it's not really in there. What's your view of the role of the African Union in the post-conflict Libya?
Secretary General, as I hope you all know, convened a meeting on Friday in which the African Union participated, where again there was a strong consensus, including the African Union, on cooperation amongst the regional organisations with the United Nations and with the United Nations-led effort in the post-conflict period. That discussion will continue when the Secretary General meets, as he hopes to, the Chairman of the African Commission. In Paris, and we'll continue discussing with them how we work together as we've wanted to throughout. Thank you.
And this is 5 o'clock shadow, excerpts from an overnight press conference at the United Nations with Ian Martin and the delegate from China and others, including questions from our colleague over at the Inner City Press, Matthew Russell Lee, in regard to the military plans for the future of Libya. There are conflicting perspectives. Rebel leaders of the TNC or the NTC are saying that they do not want a multinational force under a single nation's command. They do not want UN military observers, although they are saying that they do welcome police training. So perhaps the military occupation could yet still come under the rubric or rhetoric of trainers. The role of NATO is also being asked to be extended by the rebel leaders. And now we take a different perspective on this as we hear from the Qatari Royal News Service, the royal-funded news agency from Qatar, Al Jazeera. And Al Jazeera English might be compared by some to as the Qatari equivalent of the Voice of America. And in this report, the Al Jazeera agency does actually acknowledge the participation of Qatari troops in the overthrow in Libya. And this is what Al Jazeera had to report in regard to Qatari and other foreign military participation in the events of Libya.
Congratulating each other on a job well done, but admitting there's more to do. The chief of staff of Qatar's army welcomes NATO allies and the head of Libya's National Transitional Council. Together, they've been working to rid Libya of Muammar Gaddafi.
Gaddafi's defiance of the coalition forces still poses a danger, not only for Libya but for the world. That's why we are calling for the coalition to continue its support. Had NATO not supported Libya, there would have been a major massacre.
NTC Chairman Mustafa Abdul Jalil's main message here seemed to be Libya needs more help, while his head of defense says Libya's fighters couldn't have gotten this far alone.
NATO's support to the rebels was crucial. Benghazi would have been a cemetery. The war is not over yet. It will only be over when we get rid of Gaddafi himself. There is also the threat of sleeper cells.
NATO's representative suggests the mission is nearly accomplished.
We believe that the Gaddafi regime is near collapse, and that it will not be much longer before the people of Libya will be completely free.
While NATO's air strength has helped Libya's fighters in their long journey to Tripoli, they are far from declaring an all-out victory. Muammar Gaddafi has not been found, and there's a battle for his loyalists' last stronghold, Sirte. The British Defence Secretary admitted as much last week, saying the NATO airstrikes will continue. Back in Doha, the NTC's defence chief told his audience that even after the fighting stops, his men will still need outside help. Emiko Molu, Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera reporting on the Qatari military involvement and other issues in regard to the future of Libya. And with the Transitional National Council or the National Transitional Council still asking for foreign military intervention NATO bombing and clandestine services, and recalling that it was Qatari troops who primarily helped to spearhead the breaking into the compound of the Jamahiriya, or the so-called Gaddafi compound in Tripoli. It does appear that the Qatari military training and provision of supplies and weapons and air support for the rebels is not something that can be assumed to end immediately. And thus, sooner or later, one could expect the new rebel leadership in Libya to be saying, more or less, welcome back, Qatar.
Welcome back. Your dreams were your ticket out. Welcome back to that same old place that you laughed about. Well, the names have all changed since you hung around. But those dreams have remained and they've turned around. Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Back here where we need ya.
Back here where we need ya.
Yeah, we tease him a lot, cause we got him on the spot. Welcome back.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back.
Good spot, friend. Welcome back. And I smile when I think how you must have been. And I know what a scene you were learning in. Was there something that made you come back again? And what could ever lead you?
What could ever lead you?
Back here where we need you. Welcome back.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back. Welcome back, welcome back.
And I know what a scene you were learning in. Was there something that made me come back again?
What could ever lead you?
Back here where we need you.
Back here where we need you.
Yeah, we tease him a lot, cause we got him on the spot. Welcome back.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back. Welcome back, welcome back.
Yeah, we tease him a lot.
Welcome back, welcome back.
Cause we got him on the spot.
Welcome back, welcome back.
Yeah, we tease him a lot. On the spot, welcome back.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back. Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back. Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. That was a song of Libyan prescience by John Sebastian, Welcome Back Qatar. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and overnight there was a most alarming report coming from Amnesty International in regard to fears for detainees that are being held by the rebels or the anti-Qaddafi forces. Amnesty reports as follows. People suspected of having fought for Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi, in particular black Libyans and sub-Saharan Africans, are at high risk of abuse by anti-Gaddafi forces. Amnesty International said that after witnessing black Libyans being targeted in Tripoli on Monday of this week. An Amnesty International delegation visiting the Central Tripoli Hospital witnessed three Thuwar revolutionaries, as the opposition fighters are commonly known, dragging a black patient from the western town of Tawarga from his bed and detaining him The men were in civilian clothing. We are now joined live from the London headquarters of Amnesty International by Claudio Cordoni. And Claudio, I understand that you are in close and constant contact with your colleagues in Tripoli and elsewhere in Libya. Is that correct?
Yes, I've been to Libya myself in past years, but right now I'm coordinating our work on the ground.
What kind of a contingent do you have inside the country, and what difficulties do they face?
We have three delegates. They've been in Tripoli for the last few days. They got in Tripoli. Some of them were in Misrata first, and they flew to the west, and then they got in when the situation allowed them to do so. I think things in Tripoli are slightly improving, but it's still there are shortages of various things, and the security remains a bit precarious, including when rebels just decide to shoot in the air to celebrate things. We just met an 8-year-old that was wounded in the thigh by one of these bullets falling out of the sky while he was sitting next to his father in the car.
It's a physical commonplace, but many people do not realize that a bullet returns with the same kinetic energy with which it was shot into the air, minus considerations for terminal velocity. So it is quite a dangerous thing, and we've seen quite a bit of it. I'd like to point out that Amnesty International has a long and excellent reputation for human rights, and has also in the recent days reported on what appear to be atrocities by pro-Gaddafi or pro-Jamahiriya forces. On the 26th of August, you had a report out, Libya, detainees killed by al-Gaddafi loyalists. And 2 days ago, on the 29th, prison records at risk of being lost in regard to what may have been retaliations in that case. But there's a particular chord that is struck by your most recent report about discrimination against black or African-looking Libyans or workers inside the country, particularly in an invasion that has been supported by a black president of the United States. What are your findings in regard to the treatment of people of darker hue, African-appearing, inside Libya?
We continue to be extremely concerned about this general assumption that anyone who's African, from sub-Saharan African, or in fact, Libyans who are just, darker skinned than others, that automatically they're treated as either pro-Gaddafi or having been mercenaries for Gaddafi, even when the evidence isn't really there. We interviewed five people from Chad a few days ago who had been taken prisoner by the rebels, even though their own Libyan employer was saying, these are migrant workers have been with me all the time. And so that seems to be the general assumption. And our delegates witnessed themselves while they were interviewing in the hospital. One who was a Libyan who had lost his hand was being interviewed, and these three rebels came in and said, we're going to take you out. We're going to bring you with us to Misrata because you're treated too well in Tripoli, and threatened two other Libyans from the same town. Again, sort of, black Libyans, if you want to use that label, and told them your turn will also come. And we also saw a body in the morgue of a black man, unidentified, brought in by other unidentified men. His feet were tied and his hands were tied as well. We couldn't tell whether it was Libyan or otherwise. But clearly, they are and continue to be at particular risk of reprisals with this assumption that somehow if you're black, you're automatically assumed to be a mercenary until you prove otherwise.
Are there other parts of the country besides Tripoli in which this syndrome of racist selectivity for African-appearing Libyans or guest workers results in execution or torture? Are there other cases of which you are aware?
Well, even in Benghazi, while it was being run by the National Transitional Council in the last few months, even there we had similar cases of, sub-Saharan African being arrested and then portrayed, and even sometimes in front of cameras as mercenaries. Some of them eventually were put on buses and let go. Clearly they realized there was nothing in that respect. But others, have been ill-treated in the same way as some other Libyans, former members of the security forces, were found dead after having been abducted from their homes and then they were shot. That's not just confined to Tripoli. Unfortunately, it is a problem that is widespread in Libya.
We're speaking with Claudio Cardone in London, but himself a visitor to Libya and coordinator of the field research that is being done there by a very brave team from Amnesty International. And Claudio, having been to Libya, you may be aware, we ourselves have also been to Libya some years back, that there is a sort of a political dichotomy between the culture of the eastern part, let's just say for sake of discussion, the Benghazi, Cyrenaica part, versus the Jamahiriya dominant part in the west with Tripoli. And there is the third entity, which is the southern part, where there is a great population of people of Libyan nationality and African heritage. Can you give us some idea of how these tensions have swirled in the past, leading to the current condition of, well, basically, lynch mobs against black Libyans?
It's very difficult to say because, you know, as you know, until now, basically everything was tightly controlled and tightly repressed in Libya. I mean, there are the historical divisions that you mentioned, or geographical or ideological divisions. There's also the Berbers on the west that actually played a key role in the fighting in that in the Nafusa Mountain that in the western part of Libya. So there are all these divisions, it's hard to say how now that there is no longer the repressive apparatus of Gaddafi, how these things will play themselves out. I think, you know, there's no reason why, you know, people who are different cannot in the end come together and build a state, not just get rid of a dictator. You know, clearly what is happening right now with regard to the sub-Saharan Africans and other Libyans is something that, if it's not stamped out quickly and you know, without tolerance, then you know, that bodes bad for the future.
What are the statements that are being made by the so-called rebel authorities or the National Transitional Council in regard to this issue of racism in the revolution? Have they made clear statements, and has command and control matched those statements, if any?
They made some general statements that have been welcome, like the chairperson of the Transitional Council himself, Abdel Jalil, who at the beginning of the when the rebels entered Tripoli, said that you know, he would object to any reprisal killing. He would resign if these things took place. We also know that the Minister of Justice, who's now in Tripoli, had issued a few days ago some text messages to all Libyan mobile users to basically repeat that you know, there should be no reprisal killings. I don't think they've been specific though on this particular issue of effectively dealing with the xenophobia that that does exist in the country. So that's an area where they ought to be publicly stronger. As for the control, it's very difficult to say. I don't think they are in control of everyone. On the other hand, you know, they should do their best to at least, with regard to at least to the, you know, the fighters that are under their control or influence, and for example, removing them immediately from any active duty if they are accused of having been involved in any such such abuses.
The current of, as you say, xenophobia, as others might refer to it as racism. There were many spurious reports during the evolution of this rebellion in Libya, where people were tarred and feathered, as it were, as being, quote, mercenaries, if they were of African appearance or of a dark hue. Do you think that the incidents that you and your colleagues have witnessed against so-called black Africans is a product of intrinsic racism in the culture, or as a product of hysteria from propaganda? And are the fires of hatred out of control here?
Again, no. This it's very difficult to say, but it, you know, in any case, you know, sometimes it could even be just scapegoats. It's just easy to blame the foreigner or your fellow Libyan if it just looks different to you, so as to somehow say that there isn't really a civil war. It's not Libyan against Libyan. It's Libyans against others. In a sense, even Gaddafi had played that card by portraying the rebels as sold out to the West or to Al-Qaeda or to whatever else. So I think there's also, you know, a convenient, it becomes a convenient excuse. But I think, you know, whatever may be the subterranean cultures that play themselves out, I think it is a key challenge for this, for the new government that's going to take place. If they really want to build a state, and I'm talking about building a state, not even rebuilding, because Gaddafi's basically destroyed what existed before, and there wasn't much. For them to really, they need to address this issue at the same as the same way as, you know, the issue of women's participation in political life and discrimination against women and all the rest are things that are problems that are embedded in the society and that will need to be addressed head on.
Claudio Codone, Amnesty International has long been a courageous institution, standing up to bigotry and standing up to governments as need may be to achieve a sense of security and justice for people around the world. What kind of support on this issue of racist reprisals in Libya against Afro-Libyans, what kind of support on this issue have you gotten from the Obama administration?
Well, you know, we haven't sought particular support from outside Libya. I think, in general, what we're saying is everybody who's supporting the National Transitional Council, which is, you know, obviously, you know, fine. It's not for us to say so, but if you do that, you also need to make sure that you use your influence to. In such a way that they also respect the rules of war as they're fighting, which is what we've asked for anybody that was giving them weapons. But at the same time, now that we are about to begin a phase in which you are building a state, you're building a new culture effectively, that's where we would want all the supporters of Libya, whether it's financial, political, or otherwise, to make sure that human rights, and that includes fighting discrimination, fighting racism, and all the rest, is at the heart of what's going to be built, the same way as, you know, ensuring accountability for past abuses should be done through proper trials and so on. So that's going to be critical, that you know, human rights is high up on the agenda of all the support that you know, the Libyans will now no doubt receive in the coming months and years.
Claudio Codone is speaking with us live from London on 5 o'clock shadow. And Claudio, I'd like you to just take a moment to explain to our listeners the challenges you face documenting abuses and seeking human rights, and how people can avail themselves of your repertorial resources and perhaps give you material aid and comfort in your great work.
Thanks. You know, yeah, it's good that you raise that question because, you know, we do need a lot of help. We, you know, our work, for example, is funded just by common individuals. In the vast majority of our funds come from those donations, and people can join us by, you know, if you go on a website of our AIUSA, our section in the United States, you can see there how you can contribute, but also you can find out more about. In general, the issue of racism, but also specifically about Libya and many other countries in the world where we're working. You know, we need your support so that we can be able to send our researchers to try to establish facts in as objective and as a clear-cut way as possible, and you know, come up with a suggestion for how we can influence things so that when we build respect for human rights. Everywhere in the world, and particularly right now in situations of conflict and change as Libya is going through at the moment.
Well, people can certainly reach your organization, I believe, at the website amnesty.org.
Yes.
Well, we encourage that, and we encourage support for your great work, and we salute the courage and veracity of your deployment in Tripoli and elsewhere throughout Libya. And we've been speaking with Claudio Codone, on the Libya project. In regard to their most recent report published overnight, Libya fears for detainees held by anti-Gaddafi forces, which in even greater detail puts forward the incidents witnessed by Amnesty of black Libyans and sub-Saharan Africans being at high risk of abuse and abduction and other tortures and abuses by the triumphant rebels in Tripoli. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. Great appreciation and thanks to our producer, Thiago Barroso, and our engineer, Michael G. Haskins, also to our staff here at Pacifica Station WBAI, Public Affairs Director Kathy Davis, Program Director Tony Bates, Station Manager Berthold Reimers, and all the staff and volunteers here. We here at The Shadow welcome your comments, leaks, suggestions, tips, and questions at The Shadow, T-H-E-S-H-A-D-O-W, an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.